Toll, dass ihr dabei seid bei der aktuellen Folge dieses Interview-Podcasts Advantage. Hier bekommt ihr kostenlos die erste Hälfte des Gesprächs der neuen Folge. Das Gespräch endet nach der Hälfte des Interviews und das gesamte Interview, das gibt's exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite dieses Podcasts unter www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Hören. Advantage, Folge 18.
Moin aus Hamburg and welcome to episode number 18, the first one in English. And if you follow this podcast recently via my social media or if you heard the last episodes, then you already know that I expanded this podcast to 4 episodes each month, besides the 2 long interviews with every Wednesday with tennis professionals or coaches. I will do special episodes now every Wednesday, and I created a space one time each month with an international journalist who is also focusing on tennis a bit. And I'm happy to welcome one of the finest experienced and profiled colleagues on tour. Hello, Sasha Osmo.
Hello, Yannick. You're gonna make me blush with all those nice words about me.
Yeah, I didn't say much. Of course, you cover tennis for more than a decade for the Serbian Media Sports Group. We will talk about it soon a bit. And I think probably no other colleague knows a player like Novak Djokovic maybe better than you. So it's a pleasure for me to have you here to welcome you. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be the first foreign journalist on your podcast.
Yeah, and obviously and hopefully not the last, so it will be a monthly thing. So let's have a good start today to set a high note for the other colleagues, so to say.
I'll do my best.
Yeah, just a fun. So in preparation, I read the interview you gave the Swiss media Tagesanzeiger, and there was a quote which I find very interesting regarding Novak Djokovic. You said, I will translate it in English a bit, so it's not the complete the words, but the meaning of it is that people, you said in this interview that people can talk about the PTPA and sport politics and about the Adria Tour and the disqualification at the US Open, but in the end, Novak Djokovic is best known for playing tennis. And this is a very interesting quote. And what I want to try to do today is we want to discuss all these topics a bit and also the tennis. So let's later on, but first, I want to present the hearers a bit about you. And first of all, the most important thing, how are you? Are you good? Are your family good? Is everything fine?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks for asking. Everything is good. I mean, to the extent that we can expect things to be good right now, obviously a very hard time for the entire world. And I'm just, you know, at home most of the time, like every other, I think, responsible adult at this point. So yes, but I'm trying to cover tennis. I'm finding I'm spending much time working, so that's pretty good. And it's good that I write for a website mainly, so I work most of my time from home, so it's good. I don't complain.
Perfect. Obviously a difficult time for everyone of us, so let's hope the best that we will have a normal life as soon as possible. Normally, I imagine you would have gone to London anytime this week for your media sports club. At the moment, it's difficult, of course. I was told that only British media will have access at the O2 Arena, and I will have an online access for my media, for my coverage. What about you and Sport Group? Are you also reporting from home, from Serbia, or what's your plan?
Yes, from home. We are the broadcasters. Actually, Sports Club is the biggest regional television, and we have a website also. When I say regional, I mean the region of ex-Yugoslavia, and we are focused on all sports, but tennis is... there is a lot of tennis. So Sport Club, we broadcast Wimbledon, all of the Masters, ATP Finals, and all of the 500s. So there is a lot of tennis every day at Sport Club, as you can imagine. And I'm going to be covering London from home, just like yourself. And I feel like ATP and WTA have done a really good job in keeping us in contact with the players. I mean, it's not the same. It can never be the same because there is not that extra ingredient of you being there, feeling the atmosphere and looking behind the scenes, which can, as you know, enhance the coverage and help with your articles. But it's better this than nothing. So I think we have a decent way of covering these tournaments considering the circumstances.
Right. We will talk about Sport Club and your work there soon. First of all, I want to know why and how did you become a journalist focusing? I think you're focusing most of the time on tennis and basketball. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. Actually, I've loved sports since I was a little kid. When all the other kids were playing with, I don't know, automobiles or something like that, the ball was the only thing on my mind. And when I was a kid, I practiced tennis briefly, and I practiced basketball, and I used to play it. I used to play basketball very, very often. And I love the language as well, you know, grammatics and how to write properly, how to speak properly. So it was kind of a natural for me to be a sports journalist. And I've known that I was going to be a sports journalist since I was 12 years old. And I think that is pretty rare nowadays when I speak to my friends, all of them say, oh, good for you. You always knew what you were going to do. And some of them still have dilemmas. Can't find anything they're so passionate about. Like I am happy to be, like I'm lucky to be passionate about something like I am about sports and about journalism. So even when I was in high school, I started volunteering at one website and television. It was called B92, and it was. It was very highly regarded at that time, so mm-hmm. It was actually my home page back at the back. Like it was like 14 years ago. So from when I was 18, I'm in this sport journalism, and I think my first big article came at Roland Garros 2007. So there you go. It's 13 years, and I've been a sport club for 4 years now, since October 2016, and it's been professionally the best decision of my life because I've learned a lot, and I've learned a lot professionally. I had it's a great platform for a young and an aspiring journalist, and also last but not the least, it's the colleagues are great, the atmosphere is great, and believe me, during this. During this quarantine and working from home, et cetera, one of the things I miss the most is just hanging out in the newsroom. And I can say I am the opportunity, and Sport Club is really the nicest place I've ever worked in.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with eating dinner in the press restaurant with Yannick, no? At Australian yeah. Open.
No problem. I mean, of course, I miss the travel so much as you can imagine. At least we were lucky to go to Australia this January. I mean, when someone tells me that I've been to Sydney and Melbourne this year, to me it seems like a lifetime ago, but it was only 9 months ago, 11 months, 10 months, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel the same. It was a bit like I had the opportunity to go to Hamburg here because it's my hometown to the tournament, and to Cologne. That was the two coverages since the Australian Open. It's a bit weird if you are focusing on tennis in normal times, you are on the road so often. So yeah, but I understand your feelings. And you mentioned that your first coverage or your first big article was French Open 2007. Was it written from home, from Serbia, or was it your first experience at the big tournament?
It was written from home, but I remember it clearly because Serbia had a lot of good players, and there were Jelena Janković, Ana Ivanović, Novak Djokovic, and we called it Roland Garović. Not Roland Garros, because usually all the Serbian surnames end with an itch, as you probably noticed, not all, but most of them. So that's why I remember that joke, and I remember that article vividly because it was first, let's say, more bigger and analytical piece I've written. As for the travels, my first live coverage of a Grand Slam event was Roland Garros 2015, when
All right.
Novak lost to Wawrinka in the finals. So yeah, and that was great. That was a marvelous experience for me. And from that point on, I've missed only US Open twice, I think. Great. Yes, in 2017 and I'm not sure anymore. But and I've covered the ATP finals twice, and of course the Serbian Open here, and the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup types. I've been to Prague once, I think, in 2012.
I covered
the Fed Cup.
I see. I find it very interesting also to get the impression for the listeners. If you say your first big article about professional tennis at the Slam was 2007, but the first coverage at the tournament was 7-8 years later. That's also what I want to understand for people, that it's a very a privilege, or that you have to work hard in a business in the digital medias nowadays to be as profiled as a journalist, to have the opportunity to cover from a tournament, obviously, because there are not many spaces and not many people can go if a media has to pay you for 2 weeks of a Slam. It's a difficult thing, but 5 years of experience at Slams are very much so. So again, thank you that you take the time, and we will discuss a lot of experience later on. What I want to know from you is, you said you played basketball also when you were younger. When did you experience the focus on tennis, and what made you focus also about tennis?
No, I've loved all of the sports. I wasn't, since I was 11 years old, I wasn't able to train anything professionally because I have a mild heart condition. It's nothing, actually. I can do sports all the time on a recreation, but I can't. To practice professionally at that time. I'm not saying I would have become pro or anything. I just wasn't able to. I wasn't given that opportunity at all to, you know, go practice, maybe make some new friends there as well. But I've always loved basketball, and I've always loved tennis. Actually, my mom and dad got married in 1980, and they were watching on their wedding day the Wimbledon finals. Borg and McEnroe, I think.
Yes.
So my whole family is extremely passionate about sport. For example, when Serbian national team in basketball plays, we have a custom of us, let's say, 10 to 15 gathering in our living room, and we have a national flag above the TV, and we watch and we scream, and we often joke that it should be a tourist attraction for someone to come into our home during a match like that. So I'm telling you this so that you can understand where I come from. So I was always very passionate about sports. And during the NATO bombing, actually, in 1999, I went for 3 months to Cardiff, where my uncle lives with his family. And that was the very first time I was given the opportunity to watch tennis constantly, you know, with the Eurosport. So even once I faked that I was sick so that I could stay in and watch some Roland Garros matches, and I remember them so good and so vividly because I was like a kid in the candy shop. The candies for me were tennis matches, and I loved Agassi. That's the year he won Roland Garros for the first time, and Jelena Dokic, who represented Australia at the time but is of Serbian descent. Played great at Wimbledon that year, so it was a dream come true for me. And I remember 2 years before that, I listened to radio on some Wimbledon finals. I think it was Sampras and Piolin, and there was and in my neighborhood there was a tennis club. So I practiced for I think it was a year and a half when I was really young. So that's where it comes from. Family and just my general love of sports and basketball and tennis in particular.
I see. Great memories. But if you're saying your whole family watched the Wimbledon final in 1980, it's I don't have the experience, but I would have imagined that back in this time in Serbia or in Yugoslavia back then, it was not the usual thing to watch tennis, see, or because all the team sports are were so popular in Yugoslavia, football, basketball, handball, volleyball. So not every family was watching the Wimbledon final, I would say, or am I wrong?
So you are not wrong. You are absolutely right. It was not that big. It was not that big, obviously, in 1980, but my parents always loved all sports and tennis as well. So they watched everything. They still watch everything. So with the expansion of television now and with the sport club broadcasting everything, the sport is nonstop on our television sets. So that's it.
Yeah, I also see when you were talking how passionate you were about tennis. So good for your work later that you had this experience so early.
I think you can't be a good sport journalist without the enthusiasm, the passion, and the love for it. I agree.
So. At least it's the first thing you're feeling if you want to be otherwise. I imagine you don't want to be a sports journalist. In the first place, there's the passion or the interest in sport. The other thing what happens is how you develop when you do the journalistic education and you see pro sports and you see the pros and cons of pro sports, then maybe you are developing some things. But in the first place, there's always the passion for the sport. I totally agree. I agree.
Let me just say something.
Yeah,
agree with you. There is
as
some,
much as you want.
You know, you have a... You have an imagination. You imagine it's going to be in a certain way. When you said pro sports, a lot of things turn out otherwise. But
yes.
That withstanding, I think you need to, as a journalist, keep that. At least that's the case for me. You need to keep that initial fire within you that keeps you going, and not to get disappointed by maybe some of the things that are not so nice or that are not the way that you imagined as a kid.
True. The one hand is the personal things that are not so nice if you're a journalist or with the digitalization, you know, it's not easy. But the other thing, as you mentioned, is what is your imagination from pro sports and what turns out are the things what happened as a tournament. A lot of good things, some things that were negative, for example. But yeah, you're totally right. For example, now I'm a few years younger than you and I'm in the process. 1, 2, 3 years before that, so I have the experience to be at tournaments now for 3 years. So, yeah, every tournament and every week is a new experience, and you try to develop. So, very interesting to see. To finish that chapter of our talk, what do you think needs a journalist to be a good one when he is journalist in general, but also focusing on tennis, and how are journalists seen in your home country in Serbia?
Okay, let's get to the first question. I think what we just talked about is an essential ingredient. Okay, so the love for the sports. I think you need to know you need to read a lot in order to expand your vocabulary as much as you can. You need to be in line with the language, how it develops, the grammatic rules, that you know how to write, that you know how to speak. And as I said, by reading and expanding your vocabulary, you can upgrade your style of writing. Of course, that comes with experience. And when young high school guys or students sometimes write to me on Facebook or other social networks asking me what is it that you need to do in order to become a good sports journalist, that is how I frame it. So you need to have the love, and you need to have a proper education, and you need to have to read a lot. And also you need to, at least that's what worked for me and still works for me, is that you need to shut down your ego in order to listen to what older journalists and other journalists have to say, so that you can learn from their experiences and to be open to criticism and self-criticism, no matter where it comes from, at least you have to take it into consideration and then try to become better because of it. And I think those are, like, let's say, a few guidelines that have led me through my career so far. And I think due to those, let's say, rules, that I've become, let's say, a decent sport journalist. I'll let others decide, but I'm pretty happy with my career so far.
Interesting. Before you answer the second part, I want to go back to your answer, because I also think putting the ego beside and listening to, let's say, more experienced colleagues was one thing. I remember clearly when I did my first Grand Slam in Australia 3 years ago, I was so overwhelmed with, I'm as a professional journalist now at a professional Grand Slam and reporting about the event, that I totally forgot to maybe calm down a bit and see how the experienced guys work at the press conference, because I was so positive, full of energy, that I maybe over-exaggerate the first week because I wanted to do all things so right and so perfectly. And then just later, months later, and now 2.5 years later, I am in the process, and I notice sometimes it's good, like, to first watch and see the experienced guys and listen to other opinions to develop as a journalist. So it was perfect to hear that from you too. So at least that's what I'm feeling now with 30, that you always should consider the other options and how they do and how they act, how they write, and then take the positive things for you, for your work. That's at least how I feel.
Yeah, but when you said that, it's like you were describing me at my first couple of experiences at Grand Slams. You just want to, when you said overwhelmed, I think that's how every journalist felt when he covered the Grand Slam tournament for the very first time. And you want to do like 1,000 things in one day, which is impossible, but there is so much going on, you're always afraid you're going to miss something. But then as the time goes on, you just know, you develop skills how to prioritize something and how to, I must say, and how to be at three places at once. You know, you maybe have a colleague covering the other match, you ask him for some details, you ask another, has anything interesting happened at that press conference, and it's a little world within the world, I think, and it's a huge pleasure to be part of it, and of all that frenzy, and during that, we never stop. During that, during those 2 weeks, I think most of us come in at, let's say, 9:30 in the morning, and most of the days we never leave before 11 p.m.
Yeah, and then the time difference, let's see which tournament it is, etc. Yeah, it's difficult. But it was very nice to hear it from you, because I feel the same. It's difficult to have the balance between your own strengths and doing it the own way and find out exclusive things, and also respect the other colleagues and to see their work and to have respect. That's not the problem, but, you know, to have the right balance between your own work and to see how the other works and to cover this and the good things. It was very interesting to see your point of view. Coming back to the second part of the question, Serbia is a very passionate country with sports. You talked a lot about it. I think, like me as a German, I have the view of Serbia. I lived 3 years with a Serbian guy during studies. He's one of my best friends, and he's also very passionate about sports. So my experience is that, you know, sports is so much. And my question would be, like, if you are a journalist, how difficult is it to find the thing you have to report about, and the passion from the country, and how see Serbian people the journalistic point of view?
Yeah, when you say passionate, I feel like it's a euphemism. We can get pretty crazy, actually. So yes, it is sometimes hard to find the balance, but at least it was early on in my career. But, you know, I have to be honest with you, and the more the time goes by, I really don't have any problem with it. I am as passionate when I'm watching the matches But when I sit at my laptop, when I start typing, I completely forget about those feelings. Or in some rare cases, when I'm not able, let's say, to calm down, or when I need my impressions to sort of, you know, click, I just wait for like 10 and 15 minutes, and then I sit and I try to look at it from a third person's perspective. And I think, of course, it depends what kind of article you are writing. But if it's a an analytical, in-depth article about the match, I can't let my my feelings get in the way, or my bias get in the way. And I feel, of course, there is no complete objectivity. We are all biased with our, you know, set of values, with our character, with our knowledge, and with everything we are as human beings. But I think the responsibility and the obligation of a journalist is just to stay as objective as possible. So yes, that's what we have to strive for. And I think we can never achieve it like 100%. But the most important thing for me is to know when I look myself in the mirror that I have a completely clear conscience in terms of, have I done something wrong deliberately, or have I was I too biased with this? I know that I have done that I always do, and I have always done my best to be 100% objective. Of course, maybe some of my readers would disagree, or maybe some of my colleagues would disagree. But as I said, the most important thing for me is, you know, to have that system of checks and balances within oneself. And I think not just in professional journalism, but in life, you always know if you've done something wrong. And if I ever feel that I've done something wrong, I try to fix it as soon as possible. But I try actually not to make that kind of mistake in the first place.
Right. How would you describe your work at Sports Club? Are you writing most of the time? Are you doing 50% writing, 50% audio or TV? Just explain a bit.
Yeah, I'm mainly a writer. I mainly write for the website. Most of my time is spent writing for the website, and that's where I feel most comfortable with. I've always loved writing, and I'm kind of a perfectionist. And with the writing, you can go back and see if you made a mistake, fix it, correct it, you know, like until everything is 100% the way you want it, you can just go back. With the TV, it's not that is not the case, because for example, I will always go over my article and see if I've repeated a phrase or a word twice or three times, and then I can always find a synonymous word or try to rephrase it. But on television, you know, you just say it and it goes. You can't just go back and say the other word. But there is a format I enjoy the most is these kind of podcasts, and I've just been to one great podcast here in Serbia. It's called Wish and Go, and we spoke for like 100 minutes about tennis, and that is cool. Where you can be a bit more relaxed. Because when you're doing, for example, stand-ups for television, it has to be like official. You just give, most of the time, it has to be like official. You just give the basic info. You have to be serious. And I feel like that is not my cup of tea. I feel like I'm not as good as I am writing or in these kind of formats where you can relax and you can just elaborate, maybe have a laugh or two. And this is the kind of atmosphere I enjoy most. But the TV has been a great experience for me. I do most of TV. I do at Grand Slams or at the ATP Finals. I do some on-camera interviews as well in Serbia, basketball as well, football sometimes. But where my face is on television, mostly on during Grand Slams and the ATP Finals, where I make some for the news, you know, that we have. Sport Lab has a daily news that lasts half an hour most of the time. So I send my, I don't know what is the word in English for, you know, the TV. Help me out here.
In which context?
Like a small art. It's not an article for TV. It's called differently. You know what I mean?
But I also don't have the word. Yeah, but I think the listeners get the impression. So just go on. No worries.
So that's it. But writing is my niche, and I think I'll stick to it, and I'll try to stick to it until the end of my career.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Then let's go to the tennis topics. The first thing I want to know is how big was the Serbia tennis coverage in the years while and before Novak Djokovic went on to be a big player on the tour? So around 2005, 6, 7, it's also the years when you started, 2008. How big was tennis in the context of journalism and sports journalism in Serbia?
It wasn't as big. Actually, there was a daily newspaper called the Sportski Journal. It translates like sport journal, so I guess you can understand it. And there was this colleague of mine, older colleague of mine, that is his name is Vojin Veličković. He still works for that newspaper, and he's an extremely wise and a good man. And I've learned a lot from him. And when I was a kid, that was my main source of trying to track and gather information about tennis. Of course, Serbia at that time, let's say when I was 12 years old, maybe wasn't nearly as successful as it is today. So I would always, you know, buy the newspapers, and because that newspaper was separated in two, and usually all of my brother and all of my friends would want to firstly to take a look at the first half, because that's where the football was, and so that always left the second part for me, and the second part was basketball, and in the end it was tennis. And most of the time I would first look at tennis, look at the scoreboard and the results from future tournaments. There was this tennis player Sandra Nacuk that played for Serbia, or Tatjana Jachmanica, and I will always be so happy for them if they made the top 100 and whatnot. So it was quite different to what it is now, and there was no cable TV, so there wasn't as nearly as much tennis or sports in general on television is now, where you can virtually cover every match. There was no internet in the way that we know it now, so you couldn't pay maybe for some extra coverage. So it was hard, but I've managed to gather enough information to stay in the loop.
Right. When was the first time that you see Novak Djokovic as a journalist while working, and what was your first impression?
You mean when I spoke to him, or?
Yeah, in the context as a journalist. So yeah, maybe you can talk about your first contact as a journalist with him when you spoke to him, but maybe you have an impression, a first impression and working progress where you couldn't speak to him but saw him at the tournament and had an impression too. So it's up on you what you want to mention.
Yeah, I'll just go both ways. The first thing I can remember about Novak now is me staring at my computer and him playing against Guillermo Garcia Lopez at Wimbledon 2005. And if I'm not mistaken, he saved a few match points and went on to win the match. From then on, with him, at my first Grand Slam tournament that I've covered on site, that was in 2015. Apart from that, we have only met at press conferences, you know, where you either get or you don't get a question. Sure. And I was a young journalist, you know, still making my way, but that was a really good interview, and I'm still proud of it. And the interviews I like doing the most are the ones that you can read maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 years afterwards. And I think if you take a look at that interview, most of those answers are still are still valid. There was maybe a question about Olympic Games, I think 2016. You can't read that now, but most of the other questions you can still read them, and they could still be interesting to a reader. And I know I've had arrangement with his PR team that we could talk to for 10 minutes after. It was after his second round match with Gilles Miller, but we stayed and we spoke for over 20 minutes. So I was extremely happy, and as you can imagine, my first Grand Slam tournament on site to bring such an exclusive interview was a big thing for me. And I mean, it obviously is a big thing for me every time I get a chance to do a one-on-one interview with Novak. And we spoke at Wimbledon, I think, and maybe so far that we've had, like, I think 5 or 6, like, not maybe big interviews like 1 hour, but 10, 20 minutes, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, that's surely.
And what was your impression after the first big one-on-one of him as a person and as a tennis pro who is interviewed by you?
I was actually pretty excited to do it, and I felt like it was my own Grand Slam.
Yes.
So, that was for a journalist, it's like a Grand Slam final when you get a chance to talk to a number one player in the world one-on-one, where you get all the space and all the questions you want to ask. So I said that to him at the beginning of the interview, and he just laughed and said, come on, get out of here, relax, and let's
talk. But it's legit, because normally you just said it's your first tournament as a journalist at the Grand Slam, and if you would have been from another country and the number one from that country would maybe, I don't know, 41 in the world, a decent player but not one of the best or the best player in the world, it would be also a big thing, and you would also be nervous. But it's a totally different situation if it's the fucking world number one, and I can imagine.
I thoroughly prepare for every one of my interviews, and I am excited about doing interviews you have to find different sources of motivation. For example, my passion is interviewing up and coming players. So for example, sure. I've done an interview with Rublev in 2015, or I've spoken to Diana Jastremska at the US Open in 2018, and I was the only foreign journalist asking for an interview with her. Yeah, and for example, I've spoken to Iga Świątek in Melbourne in 2019, and all the Polish colleagues were looking at me like, what are you doing here? So that's my small passion, so that I can say now, let's say in this podcast, oh, but I've spoken to her when almost no one heard about her or him. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's a different kind of feeling, you know, especially since it was my first big interview with him. And I had a similar feeling of, butterflies in the stomach from a professional aspect when I got a chance to speak with Andre Agassi briefly. It was brief, but it was sweet, for like 3 or 4 minutes, because he was one of my childhood heroes and one of the people on my bucket list to interview. So that was Novak, Agassi. I would really love someday to have to do an interview with Rafael Nadal, but the big interview, not like 2 minutes, and Dirk Nowitzki. So maybe you can help with Dirk someday. If you have a colleague that follows basketball and is good with Dirk, you would make a lifelong dream come true by allowing me that interview.
Yeah, okay, there are many things. So first things first, I know it's a good friend of mine, but also one of the best basketball journalists here in the country, Olaf Rex. So greetings if he's listening. He's working for Spox.com, a big sports site in Germany. I worked for it also until 2018. And he wrote a book about him, about Dirk Nowitzki. And obviously now after the career, he's difficult to get. He has other priorities. But yeah, maybe if I have in contact the first foreign journalist I will contact, of course, is you to get your dream. But
so I'm just letting this go into the universe. So who knows what might come back?
Yeah, let's fingers crossed. No, but two things I wanted to add to your answer. I try to do these things too, to go to smaller players where no one cares. I had a similar situation with the new Polish Grand Slam champion last year at Roland Garros when she had her first run. I was there first round and second round in the press conferences in small room number 4. You remember last year it was the press center was in another part because they were still
down there in the basement. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And there was the smallest room, room number 4, and also all the Polish guys, the colleagues, they were staring at me like, come on, why are you here?
We what are you doing here? Yeah,
we want to do our work, you know. Go on. Yeah, so, it's a situation where you can get the first impression before the other colleagues get the first impression. So, and I also I grew up very internationally with a lot of German grown up kids from other countries, from former Yugoslavia, Turkish guys, Polish guys. And what I do sometimes, I also did it with you. I record just maybe one time a year. I record the national part of a press conference. I just for the listeners to explain, at the Grand Slam, at the normal press conference, there are two parts of the press conferences. The first one is in English for everyone besides the journalists from the country where the player is from. Not usually 8 to 12 minutes, maybe sometimes 15 minutes, depends. And then there's a part where the journalists from, let's say, if Novak Djokovic is sitting there, then only the Serbian guys can speak to him. And what I do with upcoming players, sometimes I record it and then I send it to friends and they translate the most interesting parts for me so that I have an impression of this younger player. So it was also very interesting to see that.
That's a wise thing to do, and I think that's
That's the first time I say it, because I'm also afraid, but I think some colleagues, they don't want to do it, that we do it, but I didn't publish it. It was just for my background knowledge, you know. I don't translate the quotes and then write it down, but with younger players it's what it was to get the bigger picture, you know.
Yeah. I really don't have a problem with that. I think it's a way of us helping each other out. I mean, that's a, and I think most of the colleagues don't mind. For example, you know, when I speak with, let's say, Carol, she can give me the quotes of a French players in French.
Yes.
I can give her or you quotes of the Serbian player in our native language. And the tendency is that they're going to be more relaxed and maybe give some good quotes to home journalists than to the foreign journalists. And I don't think what's wrong with it. It you know, it's a win-win-win situation, because they get painted in a light, usually better light, because they can express themselves better, most of them in their native language, and we get, you know, some extra material. And I think that's the biggest advantage of, you know, and social networks and Twitter and etc., because we can share that kind of material, and I think it is important to bring more light to players that come from non-English speaking countries, you know, because most of the coverage is in English as it is. And I think if we can help by translating, let's say, I don't know, Novak's or Lajovic's or Zverev's or Kerber's press conference from German and Serbian into English, and I think it helps the tennis community as a whole.
Yes, good point. Let's go a bit to nowadays, to actual situation. There's so much I want to discuss with you, but I see we spoke a lot about journalism, which was also interesting, so I don't regret it. But coming to nowadays, to discuss a bit the situation of Novak Djokovic. Yesterday, so we are recording Tuesday, and this podcast will appear on Wednesday. But yesterday, so Monday, I think there was a Zoom call between Novak Djokovic and Pete Sampras, which you, I think, will have seen. was Djokovic like a fan, or was he like a proper player when he was talking to Pete Sampras? How was the situation?
I think it was a bit of both. I mean, Novak's mentioned numerous times that Pete was his childhood hero, and
you can imagine how much it means to
a person to, you know, equal the record of your childhood hero. So
yes.
So I think it was a huge deal for Novak, obviously, because it's the sixth time he will finish number one in the world. But I think that adds a little bit extra because it was Sampras's record to begin with.
Yes. Yeah, sure. Let's talk about the records of Novak Djokovic. Have you been to the tournament in Vienna, or were you covering it from home?
No, I'm covering. You mean this year?
Yeah, yeah.
From home. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because actually, your coverage was so good that sometimes, from your tweets, I couldn't say, are you there or not? So this is
thank you. But it was over Zoom.
All right. Ah, okay. Yeah, good. But then it backs up your what you were saying, that the ATP was doing a good job, because you had a lot of talks with Djokovic and court, so I wasn't sure. But yeah, this is a good thing. What do you think about the situation that he was very often, he's very open-minded and speaks up about his opinions, and he very freely said what are his goals in Vienna, and that quarterfinals was enough to reach this record you mentioned again, six-time world number one. Do you think sometimes he's too open-minded, and the international press or fans see it then negatively when he says, like, yeah, I just want the quarterfinals here, and then I don't care so much because I want to refresh for the ATP finals, and I won't play Paris because I already have the 1,000 points because of the COVID situation. Do you think it's actually good, or do you think sometimes, well, maybe he shouldn't have said this?
Two different things. I think for Paris, it's good that he was being truthful. I mean, some other players have done it as well, but they have not been so open and honest about it. And I don't think what's wrong with laying out your goal explicitly and then doing the best of your abilities to fulfill it. I mean, was anyone critical of Pete Sampras for doing the extra mileage in 1998 and playing Vienna and staying in Europe, like he said, for 3 or 4 more weeks? He was hunting the world number one.
Yes,
I think if Sampras was presented with a similar dilemma, I mean, this is obviously one in a lifetime, hopefully, situation. But if Sampras was presented with a similar dilemma to play Vienna and have an option to have his points saved from Paris, where he won last year, I think everyone would choose it. That's one thing, and I don't think anyone has anything against Novak for saying that, and I don't think anyone should have. As for the other thing, for him, for that match against Sonego, I must say that I think I've only once seen Novak in his career being so. He seemed so uninterested in a match without motive, and that was his third set against Dominic Thiem in the quarters of Roland Garros in 2017. I mean, I've seen this year and all the other years, I've seen a lot of players having those kind of days where just they don't feel like it and they go out and they get. And they lose by a big margin. But I've never seen. But with Novak, it's such a rare thing to see. I mean, he can try to, you know, to be at the best of his abilities for Grand Slams or for some important tournaments. But when he comes out to the court, he usually gives 110% every time, no matter what the tournament is, when he's on the court already. And I think something weird happened with him that day, because I think losing 2-1 to Sonego is not something that we are going to see every day. He said to me afterwards that he felt weird, that it was a weird day for him, and also So it's I can't.
There was one thing. There was one thing also with an Orthodox guy from Serbia who died on the same day.
Yes, he was a prominent figure within the Serbian Orthodox Church. Novak did say that he was sad about the news and everything, but he didn't say oh, that is the main reason I couldn't play because of it. He said it did have an effect, but not to the extent that he couldn't play. I just think it was one of those days. I mean, at first when I first thought about it, I was like, how could he play like that? He shouldn't be losing 2-1 to Sonego, blah blah. But then thinking, you know, I had a this year is very, very odd, and you see a lot of people, a lot of players struggling for apparently no reason, and I say apparently, quote unquote, because I mean, you've seen David Goffin, for example, and the stuff Thomas Johansson said about him, that he just can't focus, that he is feeling too much pressure, that he is overwhelmed. And when I was thinking about that Novak defeat, I remembered my interview with Janko Tipsarevic at the start of the US Open. He said, now we are all hungry for tennis, we just want to play, but let's see how all of us react when we are into our 10th or 11th week of the quarantine, of the rules, of the testing, of this atmosphere that is everything but normal. So, and then I started thinking in that direction, and myself sometimes more often than not I wake up more nervous than I used to be. So I think that that can explain such an awful day for Djokovic.
Totally, it's an individual sport, and everyone reacts different with this COVID situation. I think David Goffin is an example of what can happen as an individual in this situation. So you see also that not everyone. We always think, you know, if you grow up in pro tennis and with the elbows out, and you go up in the world top hundreds throughout all these individuals, that you should have such a bit ego to come up and make it to the top in this kind of big sports. But then you see kind of the situations, how they are in person, and how
at the end of the day they're all human.
I think sometimes people forget. That's right. Speaking about human, but
let me just say one
please,
more thing,
please
but for me, I think it was a bit odd to hear Novak say it as plainly as he said it, that okay, I've done here what I came for, and that's it. It was odd to hear.
Das war der erste frei zugängliche Teil der neuen Folge. Die zweite Hälfte hört ihr exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Dort könnt ihr mit einem kleinen monatlichen Beitrag dafür sorgen, dass es diese langen, unabhängigen Interviews ohne Werbung regelmäßig gibt, und unterstützt zudem Yannicks unabhängige Arbeit als freier Journalist im Tennis-Doping- und Sportpolitik-Bereich.